Welcome to the Jack Hopkins Show podcast, where stories about the power of focus and resilience are revealed by the people who live those stories. And now, the host of the Jack Hopkins Show podcast, Jack Hopkins.
I'm so excited to introduce you to this week's guest, comedian Lauren O'Brien. Now, I say comedian, but she's also a writer and a producer. She's opened for the likes of Michael Che, Arsenio Hall, and Kevin Nealon. She's probably best known for her appearances on First Impressions with Dana Carvey, Jimmy Kimmel Live, and of course, Celebrities Stuck in Traffic. She's also an actress, and we'll learn more about that in just a bit. I think what I'm most excited about is that you are going to learn some things from a perspective that you've probably never taken on before. The perspective of a comedian, somebody who views the world in a really different way, and whose job it is to find something funny very often in things that nobody else really finds funny. And as a former Navy hospital corpsman who worked for a time on an oncology floor, I know how I used dark humor to cope with the things that really weren't too enjoyable to experience. And I think comedians experience the world in much the same way, just with a little different flavor. So I'm really excited for you to have these fresh new perspectives and learn about how comedians look at the world, how they cope with the world, and how they create the resilience to be able to go out on stage, face rejection, and keep on going. So let's don't wait another minute. Let's get right into the conversation with Lauren O'Brien. I've got to tell you, I've been really looking forward to this for one particular reason. I've always wanted to be funny. But at 58 years old, I've figured something out. I'm not funny. And I've kind of figured out too, and it took me most of those 58 years, that for the most part, being funny isn't something you buy a book on and learn. You can probably become funnier than you are by doing that, but you won't be comedian level funny. I think it's kind of something you're born with. As we get into talking about your impersonations, it's what you are able to do with your facial expressions, which you do masterfully. So welcome. And just know that even though I would like you to be able to tell me how to be funny, I know that's probably not something you can do.
Well, the good news, I was going to say, a lot of the comedy comes from trauma. So, you know.
Well, I've had plenty of that. So maybe I have hope.
Yeah, just dig. You got to dig in there. And the stuff that causes the most pain is usually the stuff you want to talk about the most and you want to shed some light on the most. So, just go to a little deeper into the psyche and you'll be funny.
Just dive into the pain. You know, it's interesting that I used to do trainings up and down the East Coast for companies on time management, a variety of subjects. And of course, every book you read on presenting always says, you know, kind of be funny in the beginning, warm the audience up to you. Mm-hmm. But I was never funny. So what I found that got more laughs than any kind of funny thing I ever tried to do, I would tell this story, which was true, by the way, about my wife after having attended one of my, I think it was a keynote, where I had tried to introduce a little humor. And on the way home, she said, "Can I tell you something?" And that when somebody asks you that, you know what's coming is not going to be good. I said, "Sure." she said, "You're not funny." So I started telling that story as kind of the introduction, and everybody laughed. So my way around not being funny was just to tell people I'm not funny, and somehow that made them laugh. So let's talk about your funny. At what age, I know that you kind of started doing the impersonations at around 7. Donald Duck, I think, was one of your first.
And, there's my...
and I've listened to that, and I listened to it with my eyes closed as well. That's about as good of a Donald Duck as I've ever heard. I don't know if Mel Blanc was in your genealogy stream or...
You know, I haven't done the Ancestry.com or the 23andMe yet, but I would be open to discovering that. But no, that actually came from a family friend. There was an older boy who did a Donald Duck impression, and I was so transfixed because when he would do it, his whole face would sort of change. And I've always been this way. I like to break down the mechanics of why things work, how things work. And so I just kind of systematically would stare at him while he would do it, then go to the mirror and see if my face was doing the same thing. And once I figured it out, it was like, okay, that's an achievement unlocked. And it's still how I do impressions, actually.
You've kind of already answered one of the questions I was going to ask you. I want to kind of dive into it a little deeper. Because the question I was going to ask is, do you first focus on the physiology and on the physical, or is it the auditory and the speaking? And so I'm guessing you get into the movement first.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, there are some people who they emulate so perfectly tonally, and they have this voice match where, like you said, you could close your eyes and that's that person. And I think I'm close enough, but I think the physicality is what tricks people's brains into thinking that it's closer than it is. So I think I try to take on the whole picture. And if I find that tonally I can't match it, or I'm just not quite there, right, I think I amp up and make it more of a caricature. So my impression will be like, you know, whatever physical thing or mannerism that I notice that they do, I think I just, whether subconscious or not, I amplify it to kind of make up for any shortcomings.
I like that explanation of kind of equating it to a caricature, because really a caricature is just an amplification of your most dominant features.
Right.
And so that's interesting. Last night I called my wife over, and I was looking at some clips of your impersonations.
Oh no.
And one that just like gave me goosebumps, because it was such a transformation. I mean, it was just like in that moment, I forgot that it was you doing somebody, because visually you became this person visually, Angelina Jolie. I said, "My God, look at this." And she was like, "Holy cow, that's insane." Because in that moment, I'm looking at Angelina Jolie.
And it's
crazy. Do you find that that's a necessary element for you to be able to access the spoken?
Yeah, and she's a great example of someone who I don't even think I really knew what she sounded like. I think a lot of people, if you try to just right now think of what Angelina Jolie sounds like, you're probably going to have an easier time visualizing her.
Sure.
Because she's obviously, you know, she's gorgeous, but she has very prominent features and a certain way she stands and carries herself and a poise. So much easier to access that for me and sort of imitate that, because originally when I did Angelina Jolie, someone had requested, I'd like to see that one. In the early days when I was like, who else can I give a whirl to?
Right. Well, another one that I noticed, and I noticed one aspect of it that really stood out, when you do Drew Barrymore, it yeah. seems like the lips are really important.
Yeah, I couldn't. One. I mean, because I have to go off to the side if I do a Drew Barrymore impression. There's just, if I just bring my mouth back to center, I just can't possibly, like, it just gravitationally, it pulls over to the side or else yeah. it can't be completed.
So. Yeah. So the physiology then, when you hook into that, everything else just syncs up pretty much now yeah. at this point.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. And I think for me, the what I love more than watching somebody in a movie or a TV show and watching their character is I generally love to watch them in like a late night show, a couch interview, because that's right. usually when they're letting off those little idiosyncrasies and their strange little quirks that they have, or so just true. You kind of get a better essence of that person.
Yeah, I'd never thought of that, because like you said, when they're on the big screen, well, first they're usually playing a role, right. so they are somebody else, and right. while certain things, the unique things about them still leak out, like you said, they're more suppressed, they're
yeah
yeah
yeah so, everything's measured and edited and very well planned and executed. So I like watching people unfiltered, candid, as true to themselves as they can be while being under intense scrutiny 24/7.
right. Did you get into comedy because of the impersonations, meaning when you first started doing them, you found that when you did them, people laughed and you were like, hey, I like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the impressions that I started doing, you know, after Donald Duck would just be naturally, I would be just telling a story to my family like, oh, and then remember when Aunt Diane said, you can't hold the chips that way or you're going to drop the whole bag. Like, then I would make them laugh. That sounds just like her. Wow. And I wasn't doing it on purpose. It was just that in my retelling of stories, I still do this. I just can't help but sort of embody a person that I guess has larger than life characteristics. Right. So I did that with family, and then with friends, I would like, it would do teachers or their parents or coaches, and it always got a good laugh, and then people would say like, do it again, or do this person, or try this person. So that kind of just was one of these little like parlor tricks I always had that people seemed to enjoy, and it was sort of like it's people like you if you do those sure. things, so I'll keep doing the things that makes people like you.
Right. And I'm sure it's nice too, because here's what I used to always say when I did a lot of public presenting. People would say, oh, I could never do that. You know, most people are freaked out by, you know, mm-hmm. public speaking. And I'd say, no. I'll tell you the people I admire, and then I'll tell you why. I really admire stand-up comedians, and let me tell you why. In my presentations, I wouldn't tell jokes, I would tell stories. And if you happen to find there was something in that story that was funny, you could laugh. But since it was just a story, if you mm-hmm. didn't laugh, I hadn't bombed.
Right, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. But in your world, whether people laugh or not is like the measurement.
Yeah, that's the point, right?
Right. Yeah. And so you are on stage, and unlike with myself, where it was kind of impossible to fail with a story, it's not impossible to fail with something you say on stage.
Right.
So I think people in comedy are way above people who do keynotes and things of that nature, just because the risk factor of bombing is so much greater.
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, it's funny you say that, because the reason I got, you know, when I was a kid and I would make people laugh, it only occurred like in my little fiefdom, you know, I would make my friends and family laugh. And then if you tried to put me on the spot or on a stage, it was like, no, I don't want that. I want to be safe. And I know that I'm in my little crew and I know what makes them tick. But then when I, once I got my, first jobs out of college, I went to school for marketing and I went into the marketing and sales roles. And then when I had to actually make presentations, I found myself kind of seizing up. Like I would shake and I would get so nervous and I felt like it undermined my intelligence. It undermined my, the successes that I had and the work that I had done. And so I was just like, I have to do Toastmasters, or I got to get over this because it's making me look weak and I don't like it one bit. So I started taking some improv classes to help me get up in front of people. And that was good, but I also felt like, oh, I always have a scene partner, so I can always sort of rely on somebody else. But when I'm up there doing a presentation in front of my coworkers, who I was fine with 5 minutes ago, but all of a sudden when I'm on the spot, I'm so nervous. I need something that emulates that. And so I decided I was going to do stand-up comedy purely out of the most fearful thing I could think to do. And the first time I did it, it didn't really go well. I mean, it was like, I kind of blacked out. I was sober, but I kind of blacked out and I was like, that was terrible. I am never doing that again. I'm glad I got it out of my system, but it was not like, I felt like nobody was laughing. I ended up actually filming it and then watching it back about a month later. And it was like, I heard someone say one time, you're never as bad as you thought you were, but you're never as good as you thought you were. It was definitely one of those, oh, it was not as bad as I thought it was. Maybe it was just good enough for me to try it again. So anyway, long story short is I got into it only because I was envious of people like you who could get up and speak in front of a crowd of people comfortably.
And in the end, having done that, did that help your presentation skills?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. I would say I've bombed so many. I'm not even going to try and put a number on how many times I've bombed. And then additionally, the percentage of auditions that I've done and actually booked has to be below 1%. So many auditions where you go and you don't get any feedback. It's just like, no, that's it. You didn't book it. And so getting rejected time and time again makes everything else so much easier. It makes job interviews. It makes presentations easier. It makes confronting my kids' principal about things I have to talk about that make me very uncomfortable. Yes,
for sure. Like,
okay, well, I've faced the worst thing, which is just standing there with a spotlight on you and your thoughts out there for the world, and nobody's entertained.
Right.
So
that you've kind of dipped into an area that I was really wanting to talk to you about, and that is, even though I really know nothing about the comedy world, my intuition tells me that there is a lot of rejection, even if it's in the form of a heckler or just that nobody laughs, but also on the end of booking things, just because I'm sure, like the speaking industry, it's a fairly saturated market with other people, you know, trying to come into the business. What's been the belief or the thought or kind of the idea about rejection that's kept you? Because I'm sure you know people who've tried to get into the business who couldn't take the rejection and just threw in the towel and said, I'm not doing it. So what has separated you from somebody like that?
Well, number one, I'm still very much at it. I wouldn't say I have necessarily achieved any level that I have come close to wanting yet in terms of success. but I think it's just one of those things where I know from the casting process, I've been a little bit on the other side of it as well. And you know that oftentimes it has absolutely nothing to do with you and it's not personal. Sometimes it can be the time of day that somebody saw you. Sometimes you're 2 inches taller than the co-star that they went with and, you know, they want a more even match. You know, sometimes you remind someone of an ex-girlfriend or, you know, sometimes they just, you know, wanted somebody with different color hair or whatever. So I know very much that on the casting side of things that it's not personal. With audiences, in terms of stand-up comedy, it's very easy to just blame an audience all the time. And oftentimes when everyone in the lineup is bombing, that feels better because you can at least get off stage and be like, what is wrong with them? Right. And then you'll be, you know, you'll have six comedians in the lineup and somewhere the fourth person comes through and they do something that breaks through and they connect and they win them over. So I think sometimes it's just easy to be like, I'm just not connecting and I'm not for everybody and that's okay. You know, it's very dynamic, live performances, live comedies. It's why I don't enjoy taped specials as much as I enjoy watching live comedy, because it's oftentimes it's a dance. And sometimes you can just win people over and figure it out. Sometimes you don't figure it out. Yeah, but I think that's kind of what I like about it. I used to surf a lot and it's almost like surfing. It's like the ocean is never the same place twice. You kind of have to improvise and sometimes you just get completely slammed and you're just lucky you didn't drown.
That's why when I lived in San Diego, where I lived there for 7 years,
yeah,
I miss it. A boogie board was my best friend because I could just grab it and lay on it, right? Didn't require a lot of gymnastic skills. I did a little bit of surfing, but not enough to, I mean, you've got to get in the groove physically where you can hit it every time. And as you said, even then, the ocean may have a different plan for you, even though your body's where it should be. Let me share something with you just to get your feedback on this and see if this makes any sense to you. I think the thing that stands out about you, a lot of comedians, and I think it's something that's a plus for them. And some time ago, I actually heard a comedian talking about this, though I can't remember who it was. But a lot of really funny comedians also look funny in the sense that they have either maybe big ears or a Jay Leno with a really, really dominant chin or something about them that really says they don't look like anybody else. And because of it, that in and of itself is kind of funny. And yet with you, and I mean, my wife, the first thing she said, and maybe this is just a woman thing, I was calling her over to show her your humor. Mm-hmm. And her first thing was, oh, wow, she's really pretty.
Oh, so I love your wife.
You are not. There's not really that thing about you, you know, that kind of odd physical feature that people, well, for example, if I were doing a caricature of you, there's really nothing to focus on that, oh, okay, she has big ears or she has a big nose. So the fact then that you are still able to go on a stage and get people to laugh, is it fair to say that there are more people like those I describe in the business than people who don't have those features?
Well, there's probably now, and I just recently, because I have a 2-year-old, and so I took a little bit of time off. I have a 2-year-old and a 7-year-old. So I've gone through these sort of ebbs and flows of when I'm up doing stand-up again, when I take a just self-inflicted hiatus, when I prioritize sleep over doing stand-up. But now that I'm back doing it again, there are more comedians than there have ever been since I started. You know, the first time I actually took the stage was December 1st, 2008. Did I stay consistent after that for many, many years? No, I didn't really get back into it again for a couple years after that. And even then, I wouldn't say I was consistent for another 5 years down the road from there. But there are way more women than when I, you know, I used to sort of be like, when I lived in San Diego, it would be like, we need a woman to round out the lineup. You're the only one that we can think of. There's a handful of us. And now I would say, you know, like I just produced a show last week where it was mostly females, you know, mostly women on the show. And we had two men. And we actually said, I think we need to get men on the show. we need to round it out. But I would say now it's there's so many avenues for stand up. You know, like we did our show in a brewery. I've done shows in donut shops, laundromats, coffee shops, outside, kind of anywhere you can think of. There's an appetite for comedy. So it doesn't feel oversaturated in the way that like, well, I guess, you know, I can't do it now because like, how am I ever going to break through? Because there's so many different avenues. I personally, you know, I'm sure every comedian would love to have a Netflix special or an HBO special or something like that. But for me, I've always loved the live aspect of it than anything like that. So there are so many places to do it, which I think attracts more and more audiences. And so you don't have to necessarily just be this sort of like outlier. It's people, they want to see themselves reflected more than ever. I find that my best audience, my best target demo right now are moms that are around the same age as me. And the whole, it's funny because it's true, really resonates with them. It's like, if I talk about my kids and it's self-deprecating about how I am as a mom and I don't have it all figured out and put together. So I think to that point, it's someone wants to see someone that's struggling with dating like they are. Someone wants to see, you know, someone with, you know, similar sexual orientation or, you know, struggling to find a job or feeling too old or any number of things to be represented. I just think that that's just kind of why there's comedians of every shape, size, color, age, you know, gender,
right?
Everything.
Let me ask you this. Are there people after you've done a show who come up to you and have a story that goes kind of like this? I needed this so badly. And then tell you some story about some trauma or some tragedy they've gone through and that they haven't laughed like this for a while. And where you realize you were also playing the role of a therapist and didn't even know it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's what keeps me making, even though I'm not as consistent with making, you know, videos for social media anymore, when it feels like, how could you possibly find anything funny when you turn on the news right now? I think of the person at my show who said like, you know, my mother passed away last week. I wasn't going to come, but I can't believe how much I needed this. Or, you know, they're going through illnesses or, you know, just, I haven't left the house in a while. I heard that so much. And oftentimes it felt really flippant that I would be like, oh my gosh, well, thank you so much for saying that. I'm so glad, you know, that I could make you laugh. But truly it was one of those things where like, I originally wanted to be a pediatrician when I was a child, because I always was like, I want to help people and I loved kids. And then once I got to seventh grade and I couldn't dissect the earthworm, my biology teacher was like, well, you're never going to make it through med school. So anyway, and many times when you're, especially a night after you bomb or you're hitting your head against the wall, you're not booking auditions, you're kind of like, why do I do this? And then you have something like that sprinkled in between, where you got somebody through a divorce, or, you know, every once in a while I'm having a bad day and I go back and I watch your Ted Lasso video. I'm like, wow, okay, so I am not, I'm not saving anyone's life, maybe on an operating table. But you know, if I can just bring a smile, even in the 10 minutes, 15 minutes I'm on stage, it is very like gratifying.
Yeah. Is there an element for you? I'll explain mine so I can better explain what I'm asking you. For 30 years, I worked with people to help them overcome things like anxiety, PTSD, different emotional traumas. And the reason I got, or the reason I was interested in all of that in the first place from a very young age, I was really trying to unscrew myself, mm-hmm. right? That was the initial interest. How do I take these tools and work through my issues? Because I feel like I've got a lot of issues.
Oh, yeah.
So do you find there's a therapeutic element of comedy for you personally?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And still, because I'm trying to write new material all the time, it's examining who I am as a mom. And then it's like, you start thinking about, there's hints of my inner child that are still coming out. And I'm right. Even though I am supposed to be in charge of these two small humans, I'm still a small human in some ways. Right. And so I think about that a lot. When my dad passed away, I had in 2016, it was my son was born. 2 weeks later, my dad passed away. And then a month after that, Trump got elected. And 2016 felt like a very dark, tumultuous time, but I produced some of the best content. I wrote some of the best jokes because it had to go somewhere or else yes. It was going to fester inside. And so I was just trying to be like, well, how are we going to turn this around so I don't cry and wallow? I guess I'm going to have to laugh and I'm going to have to make other people laugh with me. And
right.
It's an interesting thing trying to get people to laugh about your dad dying, but it's tough. A lot of people don't want to hear that. Like when you tell an audience, like my dad died, and then they're like, oh no, that's so sad. I'm like, I know. And he didn't give me his HBO Go password before he passed away. So
right. As a hospital corpsman in the Navy, I worked for about a year on an oncology floor. And I think something that's very common in healthcare workers, they adopt this dark humor to cope.
Mm-hmm.
So if you would have listened to a group of Navy corpsmen and the things they were joking about in private, of course, as an outsider, you might think, what a sick bunch of idiots, right?
Right.
But the outsider wouldn't understand that it's a coping mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
That when you're dealing with the death and dying every day, you've got to be able to find something about it that where you can inject some humor. Because if you don't, you're not going to last.
Yep. Absolutely.
So, how did Trump change the world of comedy? Meaning, is there something that's become off limits because of Trump, or is there an increased need for people like you? Those are just a couple of examples, but I'll just ask you, in what way has Trump changed comedy?
Well, he unlocked an impression in a ton of people. I mean, for right. better or for worse, I don't do a Trump impression, but it kind of became like the Christopher Walken of impressions. It was like everybody had a take. Everybody was focusing on different things. I will say I live in LA and it can be, you know, a bit of a bubble and an echo chamber. And so, you know, you do jokes and you assume, oh, I'm in a blue area and I make fun of jump or whatever. And it's like, oh, ha, 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 ha. We're all on the same team.
Right.
Which that's a whole side thing, I believe, about how bad the two-party system is and how we're all on teams right now. And that's part of, anyway, you know, and then you go to a different area and you say the same thing and all of a sudden is whoa, boo. And you have to divert course because it's now, okay, well now you've just outed yourself as it's an us and them thing. And right. So I usually do, you know, a quick thing to recover from that and turn it back on myself, or just make fun of my, you know, my lack of political knowledge or things along those lines. But I do think for a touring comedian, someone going all over the country, it has made it very, you kind of either have to be really smart about the way you talk about politics or your own political views, or you stay away from it altogether, or you lean in really, really hard. And so I think I've been along the middle where I just kind of just, you know, I'm just not going to go down that road because I don't want to further drive the wedge and contribute to the divisiveness. So I just kind of try to stay away from it.
So let me ask you then about somebody I watched a couple of nights ago, Wanda Sykes. I think it was from 2019. And she opened, and maybe the first 20 minutes, she hammered Trump. Mm-hmm. And it was funny.
Yeah.
But my question while I was watching that, does somebody like Wanda Sykes, do they just kind of decide, okay, I'm going to kind of have a niche market here for myself. I'm going to cater to this group of people and screw the rest of them.
Yeah.
Is that kind of how that goes?
Yeah. I think she probably decided. I mean, back to what I said before, it's like you, to keep facing rejection over and over again, you do have to accept it doesn't matter. I mean, Mother Teresa, someone out there thought she was an a-hole, you know,
right.
Like you
right.
just, you cannot please everyone. So you kind of have to decide, like, I'm going to try and go down the middle and sort of appeal. But if you want to swing for the fences, then you're like, right. I'm just going to go for 50% of the demographic here. And I'm sure. going to lean in really hard and I'm going to say really, really outlandish things and I'm going to make them laugh really hard. And then I'm going to be completely vilified by this other side. So
right.
I don't know. It's interesting. Like with my impressions, I don't really do a ton of political impressions, but I would say most of the celebrities that I have lampooned, my impressions are usually not mean-spirited, but I had people from both sides. OMG, that's so funny. You know, they had no problem when I was making fun of any, you know, liberal celebrities or anything. And then as soon as right. I did an Ivanka Trump impression and I used her own father's words in the impression, it was like people came out of the woodwork, you know, you like calling me all kinds of names and all these things. And it's like, well, you guys had no problem when I was, you know, making right. fun of, or not making fun, but just poking fun at anybody else. But as soon as I went after that side, and all I really did was use her own father's words in a speech.
Right. Right. It is interesting because it's funny to me how many people on social media who come to my page think that I'm gay all because I have a pride flag in my profile oh, right. showing mm-hmm. support for the LGBTQ community.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me at all. In fact, I think sometimes it's almost a compliment, you know, it's like, but here's my thing. You gave an example about Mother Teresa, and the example I've always used is Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones, two of the biggest acts in rock and roll history, right? But rest assured, even during their heyday, there were people who hated the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin. And that's always kind of been my guide when you get that hateful feedback. It's like, look, if the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin couldn't win everybody over, who am I to think I could win everybody over?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, let's talk a little bit about the acting that you've done.
Yeah.
How different is that, other than the ways everybody would probably know on the surface? But in what ways is acting different from comedy? And then how are the two the same?
For me, like most of the acting that I've gravitated towards or been called in to audition for or just been cast one way or another, is rooted in comedy. I think I do the best acting the farther away I can get from myself, whether that be from some sort of self-loathing or my need to create a character. So, you know, in that way, it's a lot more mechanical and less magical when you're on set, because there's people all around. There's a script of words that usually you didn't write. I mean, sometimes if you're lucky enough to film your own projects and write your own projects and get them made. But usually it's stuff that other people wrote, and you're not even necessarily talking to another person. You're looking at, you know, an X on the side of a pole that's next to the camera that's supposed to be a person's eye line.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes they'll have, I mean, it just depends on the budget. They'll have a person standing in. It may not even be the other actor, or, you know, I think that's why they have stand-ins for people who are actual celebrities. You know, they have the back of someone's head or a wig that looks like the actual actor. And meanwhile, the actor is in their trailer just doing whatever they're doing. But yeah, there's a lot of, there's just a lot of smoke and mirrors, and a lot more like, this is a business. This is a machine. This part happens. Okay. Right. Let's move the lights around. Let's film this all out of sequence. Let's edit this down. Let's just get this one line. Let's say it 400 times to the point where you're like, is umbrella a word? Umbrella, umbrella. That sounds weird because I've said it 400 times. Right. And with comedy, you know, live comedy, at least with stand-up, there is a lot more that's just spontaneous. And like I said, with an audience, there's more of a dance and a conversation that's happening. And, you know, in the videos that I do, I start to feel a little bit somewhere in the middle, because it's only me that's saying like, that take wasn't good enough, or like, that wasn't funny enough. Or oftentimes when I actually do impressions and characters, I just roll with no script or line in mind, and I just start riffing as that person. Then right. I often forget what I said, and then I got to go back and edit. And that's the part where I really hate myself. I'm like, why don't you just pick a line and say it instead of making yourself go through 10 minutes of you riffing as this person? And now you got to dissect and find the parts that are the funniest, or, you know, say like, ooh, I like that one. Ooh, I like that one. Which one looks more like her when I say, you know, pumpkin? Right. I don't know. You really hit the P in that one. So, yeah. So there is definitely in those like videos, and I'm sure any creator would say that, any influencer or creator would say that as well, that, you know, you get it down to a point where sometimes it's not as much fun, but, you know,
right.
The final product.
Well, and as you were saying that, as I was kind of comparing what you were saying to comedy, I remember the advice that Eddie Van Halen said that his father had given him. And it was, and this is regarding music, of course, while you're playing. He said, if you make a mistake, do it twice, and then people will think you meant to do it.
Right, right.
You know? So I'm guessing then that in comedy, when there's whatever you would consider a slip up or a mistake or the word didn't come out right, I would guess you a lot of times capitalize on that, pivot off of that, and make it part of the dialogue.
Yeah, or sometimes you obsess over it for 2 hours after the show and say, why did I skip that joke? Why did I say it like that? But no, nobody actually knows where you're going except for you. So you have much more control. Sometimes you have those happy accidents. I'm sure you see a lot of the videos that are on social media now of comedians interacting with audience members or hecklers. People actually go to shows now wanting to be a part of, for better or for worse, because sometimes it's not a productive, I'd say 99% of the time it's not a productive heckler. But yeah, you do have a lot more like, all right, let's see where this goes. And you don't have to be so precious with your words, or, you know, you don't have to stick to a script at all. You can just completely dive into this audience member, or you can think of a story on the spot, or you're really your own captain, but you're your own worst critic at that point too. Because for me personally, I definitely go home and I'm like, I completely botched that. I was supposed to say this word and not this word.
Right. So. But nobody knew.
No, and they don't know that. But of course. I mean, I'm sure every comedian is different, but I'm one of those that just has to go home and say, all right, what could you have done better? Let's play the tape back in your mind, even if you didn't film it.
I think what I used to beat myself up on the most is a speaker. And again, nobody knew, but you go into it with kind of this rough outline in your head of things you are going to say or talk about. And then when you're done, maybe it's an hour later, 2 days later, and you're going, holy shit, I didn't even bring that up.
Right,
and it was some of the best stuff.
Yeah.
Does that happen in comedy?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, I mean, and sometimes depending on how you're doing, you know, let's say you have a 12-minute set that night, 12 minutes can feel like 3 hours. If the audience is just not feeling you, you're looking at the back of the room waiting for whoever is running the show to give you the light. And you're like, just please, I'm dying 1,000 deaths up here. I got to get out of here. And then other times you go off course, or something goes better than you thought it would go. And, you know, something called tagging that comedians do. You say, you do your setup and your punchline, and then it works well. And while they're still laughing and on your side, you add a little, and then this, and you're kind of just, you're milking the same joke.
Extending
you're getting, it's the same premise that you're getting, and punchline, you're getting the laugh off of. You're just sort of like upping the ante and one-upping yourself. So a lot of times for me personally, I find those tags just as I've got the audience on my side. I'm adding things spur of the moment, or, you know, just kind of like, oh, they like that. Well, I just thought of this, and it's improvising. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh my goodness, I just got the light. I only got to two of my jokes. I had a whole, if they liked that, they would have loved this part of it. And you, I don't know, you could beat yourself up about, well, I stayed on this section for so long and I never even got to the stuff about, you know, how I hit puberty late. So, but again, they don't know, and they loved you, but you're like, but they would have really loved that. Yeah.
Oh, so. Yeah. Well, I hope you understand what a gift you are giving to the listeners and myself, because this is such a, you may think I'm talking about comedy, and you are, but you are also talking about life lessons from a different perspective than people normally think about life lessons and the trials and tribulations of a stand-up comic. And I think there's really, I know there has been for me, there's so much to draw from how a comedian thinks.
I looked at the list of guests that you're going to have on this season, and I'm like, Jack, are you sure? Are you sure you want to talk to me from my kid's space themed bedroom? But again, I mean, I'm sure, honestly, you could have another comedian on that has a completely different perspective. But I do think by and large, from just years and years of having conversations before and after shows, you know, just being friends with comedians. I mean, there was a time in my life where just everyone I knew, everyone in my social circle was a comedian. There is definitely a shared, like, I am going to be the harshest on myself. A lot of comedians are not necessarily the life of the party. And I mean, I get a lot of like, you? when I tell somebody a pickup or drop off that I do comedy, because it's not necessarily how I present in everyday life, as you might be able to tell from this interview. But there is a commonality, I think, with people who are, they're not surface people. They're very deep thinkers. They feel very empathetic and deep feeling people. And a lot of the comedians that I know, they're dark. They're harder on themselves than any comment on YouTube will ever be. Trust me, if you're listening to this and you're someone who leaves mean comments on social media or YouTube, they've already thought it or worse. So you don't need to say that. But yeah, I think there's a dark passenger to a lot of us.
Sure.
Oh. And then you have someone that just is like, I've never felt that a day in my life. I just like people making people laugh. I'm very happy. But I would say by and large, the comedians that I know share that commonality.
Right. You know, you were talking about how you present yourself differently and, you know, in just a casual setting. My wife laughs at her comment was, I showed her a lead-in clip of my first podcast, and in the introduction where I do a separate video for the introduction that bleeds into the actual conversation with the guest, at the very beginning I say, "Hello and welcome to the Jack Hopkins Show podcast. I'm your host, Jack Hopkins." My wife bust out laughing. She said, "Your voice." I said, "What?" Of course, I knew what she was talking about. And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "You don't talk like that at home." And I said, "At home is not my podcast. They're two different worlds, you know."
Yeah.
So I've often thought of that. If somebody were to run into me at McDonald's, for example.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be talking like I do in the introduction to my podcast.
Absolutely. And then some of it is showmanship. And I think for some people, some of it is, it's a layer of protection to say, well, if you don't like that character, that's not me. That's the amplified version of me, or that's the podcast version of me, or that's my phone voice. That's not real me. So,
Right.
Yeah, we all have different, I mean, I'm definitely a different person at my kids' school than I am in a group of my closest friends and with my family, another person, and on stage, another person. So we all do it. We all have these layers.
I've always said, like when I'll hear somebody say, "Oh, you know, Bill is such a nice guy." And my thought process is always this. Except when he's not.
Yeah.
But it goes the other way too. You know, Sally's such an asshole. Except when she's not.
Right.
You know, none of us are this thing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's changing constantly throughout the day. And unfortunately, some people catch us when we've rolled into a less favorable aspect of ourselves. Right. And others catch us at the peak. And unfortunately, that's how we get tagged for that person.
Exactly.
You know, when you think about, first, let me tell you, I guess, about this experience. It was back in the late 90s in San Diego. And I think he just passed away within the last year or two. Taylor Negron.
Mm-hmm.
He was the pizza guy in Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yeah.
Who was also a stand-up comedian. And I went to see him in a comedy club. And I didn't intentionally do this, but I wound up sitting basically on the front row. And he beat me up good. And it was awesome. I'm into that kind of thing. I realize it's part of the act, right? Mm-hmm. And I almost kind of secretly hope I'm that guy that gets beat up.
Because that's great.
you feel like at that moment there's a connection between you and that comedian. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting, he actually did a break and he came back on after the break, but I went to the restroom on the break and I'm standing in a urinal. And this is my claim to fame. Taylor Negron was in the urinal right next to me, right? So I realize it's him. And I'm thinking, okay, this is kind of awkward. We're both standing in a urinal. Do I say something? And so I did. And we had this nice little conversation. But it was like night and day, right?
Right. Absolutely.
It was part of the act out there. And at the urinals, we're just two human beings that are getting along fine. And there's, you know, and I wish that's what more people understood about comedy.
Yeah. Right.
Because I don't know where you are personally with this, but it kind of hurts me inside to think about the limitations some people are wanting to put on comedy.
Yeah.
I do realize we are in a period of time where in the real world, there's a lot of hate that's contributing to hate crimes and deaths and shootings. And I get that. And I understand what a problem that is. And at the same time, just like as a corpsman or later as a nurse, I knew the importance of dark humor with other healthcare workers in our survival. I almost think that for the survival of society, mm-hmm. there needs to always be this place where people can go and where the things that aren't okay to talk about or say in the real world can be talked about or said. And my feeling on the people who are offended by certain things comedians say, you don't have to buy the ticket.
Right.
You don't have to turn on the special. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's an element of choice in being offended when it comes to comedy. And I really hate to see that because I can see, so I'm sure it's really magnified for you, I can see the degree to which some comedians have dialed it back.
Right.
And it's really cramped their style. So you don't have to go into that in great detail, but on the surface, what are your thoughts about that subject?
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't think you can ever say this particular topic is off limits. It's the way, because some people just get really creative with how they present it. You know, like I have a sister that has Down syndrome, and everybody has these hot buttons that make you sort of tense up when you hear somebody going that way. And I found myself, you know, when I first was in comedy clubs all the time and hearing, you know, people say, some people, especially at open mics, they say things just for the shock factor. And it's really just, if I can't get a laugh, at least I can get a reaction. So I'm not standing up here just to silence. So there's definitely that, which comes from inexperience and immaturity.
Sure.
But the more seasoned comedians that you're seeing, they're usually, if you just give it a second, they're going to come back around and they're going to make themselves the butt of the joke, or they're going to make society and the way we treat these things the butt of the joke. Obviously not always. I mean, obviously some people are just like, hey, I'm going to say this thing. I don't care who it offends. And because the pendulum has swung so far, there are definitely, I think, some comedians that are like, the goal is to offend, because then they isolate a certain audience member that they don't want, and they really win over ones that they do want by that whole, look at this guy, he says whatever he wants to say and he doesn't care. But I do think there's, I think, a difference between what is said in the club and then a difference between what people are willing to say, you know, even on podcasts, or that they're going to put on their social media, because, you know, nobody wants to get it wrong. There's definitely that element.
One of the best examples and I'll get your feedback on this. One of the best examples for me that I can come up with for the difference between where something in a comedy club crossed the line and where I feel it should be okay. The Michael Richards incident, that was not part of his act.
Exactly.
That was said with a different intent.
Yes.
And it was meant to be hurtful.
Right.
To me, that he crossed the line. But if it's part of the act where it's clear to at least most of the audience that it's not being said out of hate, and that it's part of trying to get at least the majority of the people to laugh, and it's said knowing that there are probably going to be a few people scattered here and there that are offended, or at least they don't laugh.
Right.
But if we are looking at being able to only say what makes people laugh but offends no one.
Right.
You lose the element of comedy.
Right, right.
And I think if there's one thing that comedy does, it prepares people to better navigate through the real world, right? Because it almost highlights what's unacceptable in the real world.
Right.
The audience response is so strong, and the laughter to something sometimes is the result of everyone knowing that it's off limits in the real world.
Exactly, right.
And so, in a way, comedians are reinforcing that this isn't okay to say out there, rather than fueling it. Do you see it that way?
No, that's great. I mean, I love the way that you articulated that, because I absolutely agree with that. And again, it's always nuanced, because if you say like, oh yeah, they can say whatever they want, it's like, well, with what intent and with what part that is, you know, part of the joke. And like you said, you know, just because you have a microphone, you're standing on stage, doesn't mean you can just spew out hateful things that are not part of your act. But, you know, if you can't point out the absurdity in things, you run out of, and if you can't offend anyone, you run out of topics. I mean, what is safe to really talk about? And so, I think you're absolutely right. It's like, well, yeah, I wouldn't say this in a conversation, because I'm also not, the goal is to not talk at you and make you laugh or having a conversation, but there's a heightened reality going on when you're on stage. You know, I used to make a joke about September 11th, and it was just about, you know, comparing sandcastles to the Twin Towers, which I realize when I say it like that, there's probably people that are going to cringe hearing that. I'm not going to say the whole joke, but it wasn't to downplay the absolute tragedy and the horrifying events. It was really more like, I don't even know how to process how terrible this is without drawing some sort of parallel to sort of ease the tension that we're all feeling at all times, with how terrible that was, you know, because it happened at a time where everyone can remember where they were, and everyone has, when you bring it up, it's, oh gosh, I mean, it's awful. It is universally awful. So if we can like universally also just have a quick laugh and then go back to realizing that it's awful.
Absolutely. My mother, about a year ago, a little over a year ago, I guess, she had a massive stroke, and she's now, I think we've had her in a long-term facility now for, 6 months, I guess. And we're fortunate in that when we go out there, I'll say, do you know who I am? And she'll say, well, my son. But then from, other than recognizing you from there, it's all just gibberish, right? And so I've found one of the, I really rely on humor to kind of cope with that whole thing, in that, you know, she's still alive, but my sister and I were talking, but yet we're also grieving because we've lost the mother that we used to talk to every day.
Right.
But the humor that I use, like I told my wife the other day, I said, well, I said, we probably ought to go out and see Mom. I said, we can see what color of food we need to wipe off of her chin today, because usually when they wheel her back from the dining hall, you know, she'll have something they didn't get wiped off. And right. I think you almost have to be willing to go there to most effectively cope with the shitty part of it.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, and sometimes it's from the perspective. You can joke about that because it's your grieving process. It's your mother. It's your experience that you're living right now. If you heard her nurse say the same thing, right, then obviously that would be completely insensitive, because that's not her role, and there's no existing relationship, and there's no grief there for her. There's supposed to be, you know, caregiving and only that. So,
right.
So yeah, in right. that example, it's sometimes it is about the perspective and the lived experience. And I don't know, I hate to play comedy police of who gets to say things and who doesn't. But again, it's so sure. nuanced that a lot of it just comes down to intent. Right. And yeah, and I'm sure we all get it wrong, and people have varying levels of acceptance as well.
And I think that's such a powerful lesson for just society at large, is the realization that every day, all of us, whether it's in being a parent or, you know, whether you work at a newspaper office, you're a comedian, you're a therapist, every day we're all getting it wrong right. from time to time. We can't not get it wrong. And I think one thing about comedy that is such a powerful life lesson is you just have to understand that's part of life.
Right.
And that if you focus on what you've gotten wrong, life's probably going to be more miserable than you want it to be. Right. But if you yeah. just acknowledge what you got wrong, but focus on what you're getting right, right. you're probably going to have a pretty decent experience.
Right, right. And it, and you know? I also think if you're willing to listen to the reasons of maybe why that was wrong, then there needs right. to be a lot more room for redemption and forgiveness, and less quick to judge of people and their intentions. So again, it's all so very nuanced in realizing that people are flawed inherently, and everyone, I mean, again, Mother Teresa, she had to have gotten it wrong at some
right.
point.
Right. Well, and as you said, being open to feedback, I don't know if you recall or have ever seen, but my for years, my profile picture on social media, it's actually something that I was goofing around on years ago on a Facebook app for your profile picture. And in the picture, I've got aviator sunglasses on, which mm-hmm. are just a digital overlay. And then it's yeah. got a cigarette hanging out of my mouth, you know, with a right. cherry on the end, a little smoke going up. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's cool. I really like that. So for years, that was my profile picture. Now, interestingly enough, I never smoked in my life, which is what made it funny to
right.
me, right?
Yeah, right.
But as time went on, and people would occasionally comment on that profile picture, the one thing that really stuck out one day was somebody said, you know, Jack, a lot of people follow you. Do you really want to promote smoking for kids? And because they asked a question instead of just shoved it down my throat.
Right.
And then later my wife, I had kind of made a statement on social media that I'll probably have that cigarette on there forever. You know, it kind of helps screen out the people who are too uptight and whatnot.
Right, right.
And my wife saw that video that I had done. And she said, is it really that big of a deal? She goes, it doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother you. But it may impact some kids who follow you and go, oh, well, Jack smokes. She said, just ditch it. And my track record with the advice my wife gives me is that the advice that I ignore, I'm probably wrong. You know, I pay for it later somehow. And so I had it deleted. So even though you and I are talking about there shouldn't be limits on comedy, it doesn't mean that you as a comedian are insensitive to feedback and are unwilling to look at it and consider whether, okay, is this something that where I can talk about something else than this? I'm sure you do that sometimes.
Yeah. And I think some comedians and some people are just more willing to consider other perspectives than others. And, you know, I think that's all, you know, if you're looking at comedy as art, then that's up to the artist to take the feedback and do something with it, or to take it and say, thank you for your feedback. However, I still want to do this. I personally, I'm a little too sensitive. If I hear that it upsets somebody, I can't unhear that. And so I tend to either dwell or see how I can change it or just end up cutting it. So, so I can only imagine, you know, I'm really on such a small scale level than some of these comedians that have international followers and, you know, millions of followers or comments coming in. I can't imagine. At some point they probably do just have to, turn off the noise and just, you know, in the end, you're going to make what makes you happy, what makes you laugh, I hope. But it's maybe it's a personality thing or an emotional thing, how much you can just tune out, how much it affects people.
Well, I think you have what would be considered international appeal. And I'm shocked, really, after having watched your body of work, that it's not peaked over that crest. But I think it, without question, it almost has to.
You
just have that thing, you know, that special thing. And
yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, I think some of it is, you know, you have these, and I'm sure many people who are in different fields can have these, you feel like you're pushing this boulder up a mountain and then it's always just rolling back on you a little, and you push it and it's rolling back and you push it. And then all of a sudden something happens where you're like, well, this is it. And then all of a sudden you get a team of people shoving it behind you and you're reaching the top of the mountain. And you're like, oh, all this work, it's finally paying off. I've had a couple of moments like that where I thought it would happen. And then back to reality. But, you know, a lot of it is also what you put into it. I have a lot more balance in my life, self-chosen, self-inflicted, where, you know, I don't eat, breathe, and sleep comedy. I also enjoy my children and my husband and my friendships and travel and other things. So, I'm definitely not feeling any huge lack like I used to. There was a time where there was so much that my self-worth was driven on or derived from the success of my career, the success of any one video or, you know, something like that. So thankfully, I'm a much more well-rounded, healthy person now that I see things in the big picture.
I completely identify. I'm doing this podcast because I just wanted to do a podcast. If it has 100 views or 1 million, I'm not going to lose any sleep over it, because at the end of the day, I enjoy doing what we've done.
Yeah, you know, exactly. It's fun. Mm-hmm.
The last question will close out on kind of a crazy question. It's kind of funny too. How many people mispronounce your first name? As is it Lauren or Lauren?
Well, here's the thing. I'm from New Jersey, and so I say Lauren.
Right.
But there are a very small percentage of people who actually say that, and usually they're from the same regional area.
Right.
Even though in my mind, I'm like, well, it's spelled A-U. You know, if you said the word caught, you would say, right. So to me, it makes sense. But most people say Lauren or Lauren. But yeah, my Jersey accent, the longer I've lived away from Jersey, the more diluted it's gotten. But it used to be Lauren. And now it's just, you know, you can say, hey, you, or refer to me by my kid's name and then follow that up with mom.
There you go. Well, just be warned when you see the final production and my introduction with my kind of hard to explain accent, people guess me to be from all over different places. I'll do my best to get the Lauren, and it may come out still sounding like Lauren, but it comes out.
My husband doesn't say it right, and neither do my children. So, I mean, my kids just recently learned that I have a name. So, but I was getting hints of the Dakotas, and then I was getting hints of Southern accents when I was talking to you. So I couldn't quite figure it out either.
You know, what's funny is I had some facial trauma back in 95, and it two things that you were either going to be crushed by or used to your benefit. I remember I did a video one time, a YouTube video or something, and I'm reading down through the comments, and somebody wrote, "Dude, what's up with your lips?"
Oh my goodness.
I thought that was the funniest damn thing I had ever read. You know what I did? For a long time, kind of the moniker that I used was the guy with the crazy lips.
Yeah.
Right? I just used it. I just pivoted off of it. But what happened is the trauma that I had, it kind of gave me this really weird, hard to pin down accent. But you know what?
Yeah.
Now people remember my voice.
Absolutely.
If somebody hasn't spoken to me forever, they'll say, "I heard that voice and I knew who it was." So, hey, mm-hmm. you know, A+ for facial trauma, right?
Yeah, there you go. See, this comes back to what I said. You found your comedy in your trauma.
You know, it really did. I can't thank you enough, particularly because I've taken you about 16 minutes over what I promised you in terms of
no worries,
of
this
time,
is great.
But I've just enjoyed it so much. And when things are rolling, I kind of hate to just say, well, because I said an hour, I'm going to shut you down, you know?
Uh-huh.
I'd love to have you back sometime down the road. Just because there's just been a nice flow to this. It's very conversational and relaxed. And yet at the same time, so many life lessons scattered throughout. And I for that, I can't thank you enough. And I'm sure the listeners, the viewers are going to love that as well. So
thank you
so much.
Yeah. Hopefully my kids will feel the same way someday about my wisdom.
Isn't that the truth?
Lessons. Yeah.
I just had one of those visits with the school principal yesterday that you talked about. So I know exactly what you mean. You know, I've got a soon to be 16-year-old son who's entered into a bit of a rebellious stage. So it's just part of life.
Yeah.
But it's one that I'll be glad when we speed through it and
get to the other side. I remember that phase.
Well, you tell San Diego, although I know you don't live in San Diego anymore, but you're close enough.
Yeah, I get down there.
Yeah, dude, I used to love the Gas Lamp District.
Yeah.
I lived in Ocean Beach for 2 or 3 years. And I used to go run and hang out on Dog Beach and, of course, all the little beach restaurants. And
That was one of the first places I did comedy was at Winston's in Ocean Beach.
Really?
Yeah. Awesome. They're no longer, but for years, that was a room that I did. And if you could do that room, you could do a lot of rooms.
Yeah. I saw a Jewel in a little coffee shop there
before
anybody knew who Jewel was, you know? Uh-huh. So it was always, California's cool like that that's where everybody goes to start out. And if you're lucky, you get to catch them before they're a household name.
Yeah. Yeah. I did my first set, I think, in a coffee shop that they at least claimed that Jewel used to perform at, called Lestat's. So,
That might have been, I can't remember the name, but Ocean Beach is only so big. So pretty good chance that was it. All right. Well, you have a great day. And like I said, I'll get with you down the road and talk about having you back. And thank you. That was fun. What a bubbly personality. And what a treasure trove of fresh new ways of looking at things, seeing with new eyes, new tools for being able to really focus when you need to focus, and more importantly, perhaps, being able to develop the kind of resilience that fills you up with confidence inside and lets you be able to think, you know what, no matter what comes my way, I know I can handle it. I've got a toolkit here of beliefs and strategies that work. And I'm going to keep adding to it. It gets better and better every week. So I hope you had as much fun and enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Now be sure to hit like and subscribe. You can always go to thejackhopkinsshow.com where you will find every episode that's available. And also check out jackhopkinsnow.com. And that's where I've got a newsletter where I publish articles and videos each week that are really aimed at the same thing, teaching people how to cope more effectively. And yeah, I talk about politics. I want to thank you for being here for the second episode of the Jack Hopkins Show podcast. I'll see you next time.